It's Q&A time, where I'll be talking about a bunch of tax return and tax-related questions in this, the 92nd episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Thank you, as always, for listening. This is another Q&A edition, which I always look forward to. Today, given it is the end of March 2024, we are nearing the end of tax return season. I thought I would answer questions that are tax return or tax related. Many people probably have your return done already, but for those who don't, or just even whatever, because the time feels right, I thought I'd do sort of a theme to this Q&A of tax and tax return related stuff. So I did have one person send me a question offline. The rest of these are things I just pulled from the Facebook group, because there's a never ending, this is a good thing, but a never ending list of questions from people about various things. So I just sort of scrolled through just from the last few days and picked out a few really good tax and tax return related ones. So before we get into it, I have a question for you. How do fish get high? Seaweed. Do you get it? Do you get it? Okay, now it's legal. It's legal in the ocean for fish to buy that stuff down below the surface. So, all right, let's do it. So the first question, I don't use the person's name because I don't know if they were okay with it, is about state-related taxes. Now, this is interesting. So when people talk about taxes and have tax questions and like within the group, Facebook group, it's sort of generally around federal taxes, treatment. How does federal treat this? How does federal treat that? State taxes are, in my view, often more complicated. Well, I guess maybe not. So as like a tax return preparer, or, you know, as a financial planner slash tax planner that I am, I deal with folks all over the country. So I do need to get myself up to speed, if I'm not already, on each state's tax rules and tax forms. Now, generally, federal tax impacts are going to be larger than state impacts most of the time, just simply because the numbers are higher, right? Federal tax rates are percentage-wise higher than they are at the state level. So federal tax planning should usually drive your decision-making, but don't overlook state tax planning considerations, because it could definitely matter. And people don't think about that. Now, if you live in a state with no income tax, like Florida, Texas, Alaska, Washington State, I believe, South Dakota, there's a few others, then you may not care about this. But for those who do live in states that have income tax, or plan on moving to a state that does, for example, or even owning a property in a state that does, you may not live there, for example, but you own a condo in California, let's say, and you rent it out, you now need to file a California tax return because you own an income-producing property there. So anyway, so I think it's interesting. People generally don't give much thought to state tax issues, but here's a good one relating to residency. Now, this is a hairy question potentially, and I'll explain what I mean. So here we go. Question says, hey there, I live in North Carolina that has a state tax on pensions. I'm retiring to Tennessee, which does not have a state income tax. Tennessee has a 183-day requirement to meet residency status. Does that mean North Carolina will take out state taxes until 183 days have passed? Thank you very much. So a few things going on here. One question is state residency, how to establish state residency. When do you give up state residency? The other one is about pension with income tax withholding. So it's two separate things. Let me start with the residency thing. So this could be prickly, and every state's slightly different. So this person references the 183-day thing. That simply means if you're in the state more than half the year, a year being 365 days, 183 days is more than half. So the thought is that if you're there, living there, doing things there, more than half the year, you are a tax resident of that state. Where things get difficult is that residency from a tax perspective isn't necessarily the same as like residency, where do you physically put your body day to day. Oftentimes it is, but it's not quite that simple. So let me start by saying, like, what determines when you are a tax domiciled, you know, a tax resident of a certain state? There's no uniform black and white checklist. It's facts and circumstances, but generally speaking, it'll be things such as where's your primary residence or what you consider your primary residence. This got murky during the pandemic where people started working from home and they started living out of their vacation house or bought a second house and split time between them. So which one's your primary residence? So normally everyone's going to have a primary residence unless you're a true traveler, gypsy or something where you don't really live anywhere. Everyone has a permanent residence, or at least you have to from a state tax perspective. You got to be anchored somewhere. So most, you know, commonly it's like, where do you spend most of your time? Now, if you only have one, let's say you have two properties, one in New Jersey where I live, and that's where you spend most of your time, and you got a vacation condo in whatever, upstate New York, and you're there, you know, 4 weeks a year, it's pretty clear you're a New Jersey resident just from looking at that so far. So the 183-day thing usually means half the year you're in a certain spot, that's a resident. But there's more to it than that. Like I said, it's where you own your property, specifically the one you consider your primary residence. Where do you go to after work? Where do you go to as sort of like your home base? That is your primary residence. Where's your driver's license located? In what state do you have a driver's license? So let's say you're a snowbird. You have a house up in New York and then a house down in Florida. Which one do you spend the most time in? You know, the 183-day thing. Where's your license? Is your license based out of New York, where that's still your home state, and you're just living in Florida 2 months out of the year? Or is it based in Florida? Where's your where you're registered to vote? You know, which state, which district? Is it New York? Is it Florida? Where's your place of worship? Church, mosque, temple, whatever. Where are you sort of officially registered as a congregation member? Where do you spend your money? Like if you look at credit card statements, or if you ever got audited and someone went through your credit card statements, what would it show? Are most of your purchases happening days in Florida or days in New York? Things like that. What else? I'm probably skipping a few here. But I mean, those are sort of the biggies. Now, if push comes to shove and you're a big ticket enough fish for a state to try to fry, they can subpoena and get your cell phone records to look at the GPS location of where you were. So example I heard of on a podcast with these tax attorney folks who work on cases where clients try to leave high tax states and go to no tax to income tax states like Florida, for example. I don't know the specifics, but the gist of it was there was a really, you know, wealthy, high earning couple that lived in New York for their whole life. They claimed they moved to Florida. They sure enough did own property in Florida, but they claimed to move to Florida, and somehow New York State caught wind of the fact that these people said they moved and didn't quite believe it. So they started digging into it. It ultimately went to court or something. And the state of New York was able to pull GPS records from the people's cell phone provider and say, no, you were in, you know, Florida. I'm sorry, you were in New York for whatever, 200 days out of the year. We can prove it. This was your cell phone. So no, you're lying when you tell us you were in Florida for 8 months out of the year. That was not the case. So this stuff is traceable when push comes to shove. That they, you know, if they really want to, they can prove you're not there. So where am I going with this? So anyway, going back to residency, like the common flow is people leave the high tax places like New York, New Jersey, California, whatever, to go to a low tax or no tax place like Texas, Florida, Nevada maybe. But so the question then becomes twofold. How do you establish tax residency, tax domicile in the new state, which is obviously one measure of importance? And that's what this question was. It says Tennessee requires you to be there 183 days to consider yourself a resident there. Check. Okay, good. But it's not just establishing residency in the new state that matters. It's also proving you're no longer a resident of the state you're leaving. That matters as well. So like South Dakota, I believe it is, has super, super liberal residency rules where you only need to be there one day. They will gladly welcome anyone into the state and call them a South Dakota resident. South Dakota doesn't have income tax. So like people often try to go there, legally or not, to not pay income tax. So the problem isn't establishing tax residency in a new state. It's shaking off residency in the old state. A case comes to mind. Again, I'm forgetting the specifics, but it was a couple in Minnesota, fairly high tax state, that retired and wanted to do the RV thing. They bought an RV, and I think they sold their house in Minnesota. They bought an RV, and they're traveling the country for a few years. What they did was they set up shop in Florida. There's places in Florida where you can rent an address, like basically a shared mailbox at an RV sort of mail forwarding campground. You can easily get your Florida driver's license. You can easily register to vote in Florida. Florida is one of those states that will gladly welcome you to be a resident there. That's not the problem. The problem is proving you're no longer a resident of Minnesota in this case. So this particular couple, maybe it was South Dakota, I don't recall. It was one of those no tax states they went to. So they sold their house in Minnesota, bought an RV, traveled the country for a few years, and claimed they were a resident of South Dakota, let's say, which they were. South Dakota gladly said, yes, you are a resident. Be here one day. You're good. Well, Minnesota pushed back. These must have been fairly wealthy clients. Minnesota somehow found out, challenged them, and said, no, you are still Minnesota tax residents. And they won. Minnesota won. So the issue, again, isn't establishing residency in a new state. It's getting rid of residency in your old state. Now, where it gets tricky is with this RV thing. The people said, we sold our house in Minnesota. We don't own property there anymore. We own an RV. We are literally in Minnesota, whatever, 2 weeks out of the year because we're traveling the whole year. How are we possibly still Minnesota residents? And Minnesota made the case, and I think this generally holds, until you formally and officially truly re-anchor, re-domicile somewhere, you never give up your old domicile. So in the case of, you're a wandering RVer, you're still, and you don't have a state you live in because you're bouncing around every 2 weeks, you still technically have tax domicile in the state you left. So keep that in mind. Now, again, unless you're a higher income, higher wealth client, it may not matter. It's not worth the state's resources to try to come after you if they even were to find out. But just simply because South Dakota says, come here one day, boom, you're a resident. Well, that's not good enough to actually shake off your old domicile from Minnesota in this case. The other sort of like facts and circumstances thing is, in addition to where you spend your time, where your license is, where your voter registration is, where's your family and friends? If a case could be made that you're likely moving back to Minnesota, in this case, where you left, because all your grandkids are there, your friends are there, whatever, that doesn't help your case. Like, you can say, I got an RV. I don't know where I'm going to land in 3 years when I get tired of this RV thing. Well, that may not be good enough because Minnesota can say, it looks like you still have family, friends, and reason to be back here. So again, you didn't leave your Minnesota domicile yet just because South Dakota said you're a South Dakota resident. So anyway, so that's kind of it about establishing domicile. So to the question here, keep that in mind. Are you really a Tennessee resident yet? Or are you still a North Carolina resident? But that aside, the next part of the question was, will North Carolina still take out taxes for the 183 days until you have been in Tennessee for 183 days? That depends. Your pension will take out basically whatever taxes you tell them to. If you tell them I'm now a North Carolina resident, they will take out North Carolina taxes if you ask them to. If you tell them I am now a Tennessee resident, they will take out Tennessee taxes if you ask them to. To my knowledge, the pension provider, they don't, it's not their business to figure out what state are you resident of. I think that basically what you tell them is what they'll do, but they don't automatically withhold. You do have to ask them to withhold. Some states do have a mandatory withholding unless you consciously opt out of it. They will by default withhold if you live in certain states, but it's easy enough to opt out. You just sign an affidavit and all's good, whatever. So that's my long-winded answer to this two-part question. Listener, or I guess writer, I should say. Hopefully that made sense, and hopefully that helped all of you, the rest of you listening. Next question. Do capital gain losses in excess of the $3,000 maximum carry over until they are used up or just to the next tax year? And he gives an example, but I'll try to sum this up. So if you have a regular brokerage account, not an IRA, not a Roth IRA, not any other sort of qualified account where the taxation doesn't matter in the current year, if you have like a regular brokerage account and you sell something at a loss, meaning you sell it for less than you paid for it, that loss is deductible at least to some extent. So let's assume you sold a bunch of stocks and the total loss on these stocks were $40,000 for the year. You have no other gains. You didn't sell anything gains. You just sold stuff at a loss for a total of $40,000. Well, you can't deduct all $40,000 of loss. You can only deduct up to $3,000 against the rest of your income. Now, notice I said there was no gains. If the person had gains, like for example, let's assume they sold other stocks at $15,000 of gains, you would net it together. $40,000 of loss, $15,000 of gain would be a net $25,000 of loss for the year. So if you have a net loss, you can only use up to $3,000 of that to deduct against the rest of your other income, wages, pensions, dividends, interest, whatever. So what do you do with that amount you can't deduct? So let's assume again, $50,000 is your total net loss for the year. You can only deduct $3,000 of it on your return this year. The $47,000 carries over to the next year. Now, it is not you get 1 year to use it and it's gone, you have the rest of your life for these carryover losses to be used year to year to year. So in the second year, when you carry over the $47,000 a loss, if you have any gains that year, those gains will be offset by the loss and will eat up that loss. If you have no gains in that second year and you have this $47,000 of net loss carried over, you can deduct $3,000 of it that year and then carry over the remaining $44,000 to the next year and keep doing this every year until you nibble away $3,000 a year deduction until it's eventually gone. Now, if you die, these unused, undeducted losses will die with you. If you're married, your spouse, you know, assuming they, your spouse gets your stuff, your spouse has to joint own it. Actually, I think if you're the sole owner and your spouse isn't an owner on the account, I believe unused losses get wiped away. So, hold that thought. I have to look that up. But let's assume you're single. You have, you know, you die with $20,000 of unused, you know, undeducted loss carryover. Those stop. Your heirs don't get the benefit from that loss you didn't use, unfortunately. So that's that. Now, and side note, I've been saying $3,000 is what you can deduct each year. That holds true if you're married filing joint, if you're single, if you're head of a household. If you're married filing separately, I think you can only deduct $1,500 per year, not $3,000. Against your other sources of income. Next, this one's kind of long, see if I can sum this up. But the gist is someone had their taxes done by a tax preparer. The tax preparer informed them that you have a $1,000 underpayment interest penalty on federal tax return and a $500 interest underpayment penalty on their New York State return. This was despite the fact that they paid estimated payments in conjunction with doing large Roth conversions, and they tried to time the payment of those estimated taxes with the quarters in which they did the Roth conversions. So I guess what happened is they probably did the conversions later in the year. They said, okay, let me pay taxes now later in the year, and thought they'd be good, but they weren't. They got a penalty. Why this happened, and there's a second part to the question, but I'm just trying to explain the backstory now. Why this happened, and this is a real long topic that I have a video on that I can share, is that when you're making estimated payments against income you had for the year, whether it was from wages or Roth conversions or whatever, the IRS assumes by default that all the income you earned or, you know, conversions you did, regardless when in the year they happened, the IRS assumes they were spread out as if you did them equally throughout the year. They then, by default, expect you to make estimated payments equally throughout the year. If you didn't know you were going to do Roth conversions until December when you did a big fat one, you had no way to know that earlier in the year you should have been paying estimated taxes for that conversion you're doing in December. So you make your one big estimated payment in December, think you're good, but you're not, because the IRS, again, assumes you should have been paying that tax nut equally throughout the year. And because you didn't, they will charge you interest underpayment penalty on the amounts you should have paid earlier in the year but didn't. So this person then asked their tax preparer to calculate the penalty using Form 2210. So what is that? So Form 2210 is a form, it does a few things. It calculates the underpayment interest penalty, but there's also a section where you can, what's called annualize your income. You can say, hey, IRS, I didn't make even, you know, four quarterly equal estimated tax payments because I had lumpy and unknown income in the year, such as I did a really big Roth conversion late in the year that I wasn't planning on early in the year. So I had no way of knowing I should have been making estimated payments earlier in the year. That's why I made one big single estimated payment in December. So on this Form 2210, you can annualize your income, which is where you basically override the assumption that all income is earned equally throughout the year, and instead say it wasn't equal. I got a big fat taxable income in the fourth quarter when I did my conversion, which is why I made one big fat estimated payment in the fourth quarter. So if you do that well and you fill out this form, the interest underpayment penalty can be reduced or completely eliminated. In this person's case, it was completely eliminated. So if they didn't do this form to annualize their income, again, they would have owed a $1,000 federal penalty and a $500 New York State penalty. They asked the tax preparer, hey, can you please annualize our income? Those penalties went away to zero. So this person saved $1,500 in underpayment penalty interest. So that's what you need to know about underpayment penalties and Form 2210. Just additional comment. So tax return preparers a lot of them won't voluntarily ask, hey, when did you do your Roth conversion? Or, hey, did you have lumpy or unknown income throughout the year? They'll just simply get your documents. They'll see a 1099-R that shows you did a conversion for $100,000. They'll enter to your tax prep software. And their tax prep software is going to say, you have an underpayment penalty because you made a late fourth quarter estimated tax payment. Some preparers may ask, you know, the more thorough ones that have the time and willingness and ability and interest in really digging in may ask, but a lot of them won't. And it sounds like this person didn't. And I'm not saying that's bad. I mean, this is technically, it's up to the tax return preparer to offer up all relevant information. I'm sorry, to the taxpayer to offer up all relevant information. But good preparers who aren't super swamped, which is hard to come by around tax time, you know, ideally should be asking questions about this. So anyway, so where am I going with this? It's know that this annualization thing exists if you have interest payments that are due on your return. Know that if you had lumpy income, especially late in the year, annualizing your income could help reduce or eliminate the underpayment penalty. And it's on you to, if you do your own taxes, to know that, to do it. Or if you use a tax return preparer and you do see a penalty, ask him or her about annualization and whether or not it can help you. Now, don't be surprised if they charge you more because it is additional work and operations for them to do it. But still, if it saves you $1,500 in the case of this person, it's worth it. One other related comment, the interest the IRS charges on underpayments of tax throughout the year is quite high. It's 8% currently. A couple of years ago at the, you know, the depths of the pandemic when interest rates were really low, it was only 3%. So these interest underpayment penalties weren't that huge of a deal a few years ago because the interest was cheap. Now with 8% interest, like you definitely want to do the work to try to avoid these underpayment penalties if possible. So keep that in mind. Next, this wasn't a question, but I thought it was worth mentioning to everyone. The question of when should you file your return? Now, I assume most of you listening know tax returns are due by April 15th, unless it's like a weekend or holiday, then it bumps out a little. But tax return deadline is April 15th. You can get an extension for 6 months that brings you to October 15th. Anyone could file an extension. You don't have to explain why you're doing it. Anyone could get an extension from the IRS for 6 months. And in states as well, most if not all states allow you to get an extension, no questions asked. Now, extensions aren't as easy as they sound. You're still supposed to, because technically an extension isn't an extension to pay the taxes you owe. It's just an extension to file your return. It's a head scratcher. So like you still kind of basically need to do as much of your return as you possibly can by April 15th, because to the extent you're going to owe money, you have to pay that by April 15th. The extension just gives you 6 more months to file and submit your return, but the tax needs to be paid by April 15th. Go figure, right? So like you in effect still have to do your return as best you could, even if you file an extension, because if you owe a payment, you got to get that in. But anyway, so when should you file a return? Now, many people like to do it as quick as possible. Get it out of the way, especially if you're owed a refund, you know, get that money in hand. Great. Other folks like to wait till the last minute, sometimes just because they procrastinate, you know, not for any reason better than that. But there are some, in some cases, good reasons why you should wait. Things can change. You know, certain documents you get could be amended or updated by the provider of the document, such that if you filed your return as early as you can, and then 3 weeks later, you get a revised 1099 or something, well, you may need to go back and amend your return. Especially if you owe money, you're going to amend it because you want to pay it so they don't penalize you. Or if you're due to get money back, you probably want that money back, right? So you're going to have to amend it. Some documents, there's a really low risk it's going to change. Like for example, if you're retired and all you get is a pension and Social Security, you have no brokerage account, you have no like private investments or anything that generates a K-1, which I absolutely hate K-1s. They do nothing but complicate the world. You know, really straightforward. You get Social Security, you get a pension, that's it. You will have the 1099 for both of those things by the end of January or really soon thereafter. Chances of those two getting amended, super low, super low. So if that's your case and your only relevant tax docs are 1099s for Social Security and a pension, I'm going to say go ahead and file it as soon as you get it because the chance of those getting changed after the fact is so low, it's, you know, virtually zero. So no point in waiting unless you want, but you know, if you want to bang it out quick, go ahead and do it. Where it does get a little more challenging is if you have a brokerage account, you'll get a consolidated 1099 from that. The more positions, the more activity there is in your account, the more likely things will get restated. I had this happen 3 times so far this season where I'm going to have to amend 3 returns for people. It's not their fault. It's not my fault. It's just, it is what it is. the 1099 came out, I don't know, let's say mid-February, perhaps, I forget. And so it showed whatever, it showed dividends of, I'm making this number up, you know, $15,000, 13,000 of which were qualified dividends. Did the return, all good. They owed some money, paid it, done, or got a refund. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. Return was filed. Like a week later, got an updated 1099 from the custodian, and it changed the amount of dividends that were qualified by a little bit, to the point that the person is now due another $20 back of refund, which is like, if it was only a dollar, I'd say, forget it. We're not doing it. But $20, it's like, you know, that's a lunch at some place, not a lot of places anymore, but you know, it's a lunch somewhere. It's worth doing. Now, the question is, if you do your own taxes and you don't charge yourself, or your software doesn't charge you to do an amendment, fine, go ahead and do it. But if you use a preparer and an amendment is due because of a reason that's not the preparer's fault, the preparer should be charging you because it is time and service from them. Now, I don't know what the average is for an amendment, $100 probably. So if it's going to cost you $100 to have a tax preparer amend your return just so you can get a $20 refund, additional refund, don't do it, obviously. You're still $80 in the hole. Just let it go and you know, don't bother. Or if you know, if you use a preparer who's not going to charge you, then fine, go ahead and file it, because $20 is $20, right? So that's just something to consider. So what I'm saying is, there's a case to be made. If you have a brokerage account, you should wait till later in the tax filing season, just in case there are any revisions to your 1099. Now, the trouble with that, if you do it yourself, fine. You know, you have the time and capacity. If you use a tax return preparer, he or she may not be okay with you waiting till, you know, as close to April 15th as possible, because who knows what their backlog or, you know, docket of business is, and how many of their clients are late getting them stuff and trying to jam it in last minute. So you don't want to wait till April to get your stuff to a tax return preparer, because that could be crunch time for that person. Now, I intentionally don't do a lot of tax returns. I mean, it's a fair amount, but not so much that it consumes me. But a lot of tax return preparer shops are completely swamped and underwater for two straight months, from you know, February through to mid-April. So when to file, I don't know, and take this for what it's worth. If you have a brokerage account, that's more likely to have an amended 1099 than other stuff like pension, social security, bank account interest, for example, is really straightforward. So maybe you wait, maybe you don't, but I'm not sure how to wrap that up. That's it. I just want to put that out there. You know, in some cases, I think it's completely fine to file ASAP. In other cases, it may be worth waiting. If you get K-1s from something, those are going to be a headache for you regardless. A, they're often late. B, they commonly get amended even after the fact. I just now, 2020, here we are, early 2024, got an amendment for a client's 2021 K-1 from a small business that she's a really minority owner in. So I had to go back and amend a 2021 return. You can't avoid K-1s in all cases. In this case, it's, you know, a family business that she has a small stake in. So it is what it is. But my word of wisdom is, if you have investments, certain things like MLPs, master limited partnerships, which are usually like oil and gas pipelines and stuff, though, because they're partnerships, technically they file K-1s. You get a K-1 as an owner in that. If it can be avoided, don't let the tail wag the dog. But if you're indifferent, or it's a really small position you're considering getting and it's going to generate a K-1, I'd say don't even bother, because the headache it's inevitably going to cause in your taxes isn't worth it. All right, final question. This one is not tax related, but I thought this was a good lead up. Either next week's episode or maybe the follow. So maybe the first episode of March, of May. I want to talk about advisory fees. It's something I'm passionate about. I have very strong opinions about. And I largely for the good of consumers, because I came up with these views and beliefs and opinions while I was a consumer, not an advisor, but I was a consumer. I was like, the way the industry charges it doesn't make sense and it's really arbitrary. So I set out to create a business where I charge how I think it makes much more sense. So anyway, so that's going to be probably next week or May's topic, all about advisory fees and my views on that. But the question that is related to fees that I'll leave you with is this, and this is from the Facebook group as well. I'm considering hiring a financial advisor. I would like opinions on whether or not actively managed portfolios by a fiduciary financial planner are worth the 1.25 to 1.5% fees. One of the biggest reasons is to remove me from the picture, as I have a tendency to let emotions influence my decisions. I mean, if they can outperform what I do by at least a fee percentage and probably more, It seems like a no-brainer, right? Question mark. All right. So this person's referencing the 1.25 to 1.5% fees. Majority of the industry, particularly those that manage investments, charge what's called percent of assets under management or percent of AUM. Whatever you have that they manage for you, they charge you typically 1 to 1.5% of it. So for example, you have $500,000 under management by an advisor and they charge 1% of AUM. That means they would charge you $5,000 for the year to manage that $500,000 for you. Did I say they'll charge you $5,000 for the year to manage that $500,000 for you. Now, typically they break it up quarterly. Like you know, you won't pay $5,000 in one shot. You'll pay $1,250 every quarter. And they bill that directly out of your account. You usually don't have to pay by credit card or bank or whatever. That fee comes right out of your investment account they manage. Now, and also the $500,000 is going to fluctuate. Maybe one day it's 502,000, then the market does well and it's 520,000. The market drops some and it's 490,000. So when they do the billing every quarter, it's going to be a percentage of whatever the balance is then, which means the actual dollars you pay aren't going to be a precise $5,000 in this case. It's going to bounce around, you know, something more or less than $5,000 for the year, depending where your account is. And if you put more money into the account, like you, whatever, sold your house and you roll the proceeds into this account that they manage, because your AUM goes up, the fee now goes up. You know, it may still be the same 1%, but it's 1% on a larger dollar amount. So the total dollars you're now paying this person are going to go up because of it. And vice versa, if your assets go down, you take $200,000 out of your $500,000 to pay off your house. There's now $300,000 of assets under management, and they charge 1%. You're now paying about $3,000 for the year. So this person's question is the fee worth it? Well, quick again preface to what I'm going to talk about next episode or next month is that I think charging as a percent of assets is an incredibly, terribly arbitrary and illogical way to set your fee. It's the dollars that matter. How many other things in your life do you pay in percentage terms as opposed to dollar terms, right? The dollars matter. Is 1.25% to 1.5% too much? I say it depends on what the asset size is they're charging that on. If you have $100,000 under management and they're charging you 1.25%, 1.5%, you're only paying $1,200, $1,500 a year. That's dirt cheap. You're not paying enough, in my opinion, for what they're likely doing for you. The flip side, you have $2 million under management. You're paying $30,000 a year, up to $30,000 a year, which I can say with confidence, unless you're the most like super complex person and have these really off the beaten path, weird investments that need a lot of managing and handholding, you're almost certainly grossly overpaying if you're paying $30,000 a year, right? So is 1.25%, 1.5% too much? It depends. It depends how much money they're charging that on and what they actually do for you. So this person anyway is talking about really just in the investment management context, saying he's looking at an advisor who actively manages. So a person who's trying to like go out and proactively beat the market and do better in the market, which my view and lots of research show is futile over the long run. Most people can't outperform the relevant benchmark or underlying index. But the person's asking if the advisor can theoretically outperform the market or outperform the alternatives. And as long as they outperform by more than the 1.25%, 1.5% fee they charge, is it worth it? I'd say yes. Simple math would say yes. Especially if it stops you from being your own worst enemy. This person admittedly said that, I let my emotions get involved and that can sometimes make bad decisions, like knee-jerk reactions or whatever. If an advisor can help you avoid big mistakes, the fee could be worth it. But you have to look at the dollar amounts you're paying, what you get for it, right? For $1,000, sure, it's worth it. For $30,000 a year, is it worth it? I don't know. Are you going to mess yourself up by more than $30,000 a year? Probably not likely, but who knows? So anyway, to answer this person's questions, sure. If you can actually accurately and honestly measure how well the advisor's portfolio does versus the alternative or the benchmark, and the advisor consistently beats that benchmark by 1.25% or 1.5%, sure, their service is worth it. But I'm going to say it's not possible. No one's going to consistently outperform a benchmark or the relevant index by 1.25%, 1.5% per year. It's just not going to happen. If it is, they are doing something underhanded or fudging their numbers or whatever, because it's just not going to be possible. Some years they'll do better. Some years they will underperform and lose you money relative to the index. They're not going to give you money back when they do, but some years they will lose money. So anyway, to answer your question, yes, Poster, but it's much bigger. It's much more involved answer than that, which I will gladly dig into more in either next week's episode or first episode of the first Thursday of May. So that's that for this episode. Hope you all enjoyed it. As always, if you like this podcast, it'd be greatly appreciated if you would take a moment to leave a review, a thumbs up, a like, or whatever on whichever podcast listening platform you use. And check out the retirementplanningeducation.com website, where you can find the YouTube channel, Facebook group, whole bunch of free stuff. And I think there's some other goodies on there too. So that's that. Thank you as always for listening. Take care, and I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.